Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12-powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Hey everybody, this is Wei Ting here, and we are here about to present to you a free edition of a Post Wrestling Cafe exclusive known as Rewind Away. Of course, out today is The Smashing Machine starring Dwayne Johnson, a biopic about Mark Herr. What many of you may or may not be aware of is that it is a movie based on an existing documentary, which we have previously reviewed. So some of you may have some interest in knowing a little bit more about the Mark Herr story before you watch the movie. Some of you may have already seen the documentary or maybe plan on seeing the documentary before or after watching the movie. Well, save this podcast and treat it as a preview for all 191 editions of Rewind Away. So again, postwrestlingcafe.com for access to the entire archive. And let's take it all the way back to February of 2024 as we talk about The Smashing Machine documentary on Rewind Away.
Because we're just getting started.
And you can see Scott Butsky really put together.
Waiting for my man.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Rewind Away number 150. The party has begun. Big zero at the end of this number. Congratulations, Way. 150. One away from 151.
I know, 150. I expected us to make it this far, actually. I can't
say
I
never expected. The exclamation point anniversary.
Yeah, yeah. I always knew we'd make it to 150. I think it's very likely we'll make it to 200, maybe even 250, maybe even 500. Okay, I'm going to be ambitious.
On to The Smashing Machine we go. So this is the, a really well-acclaimed documentary that came out. This debuted at the 2002 Tribeca Film Festival. That was the first year of Tribeca. And this featured director John Himes, who was he was the director of this, and production began in August of 1999. And in some of the research I did, Mark Herr did have approval of the final cut, but I guess the agreement was he was not able to see any of the footage until it was done, edited, and shown to him. And and then we had the Smashing Machine, but that was sort of the agreement that was made here. And this was one that, especially in MMA circles, it was kind of like the documentary. And I would say many people to this day that would, like, certainly of MMA, but I think you can include, like, you know, pro wrestling equivalents as well. Like, this is one of the better documentaries.
I would certainly say so myself. I think to this day, one of the rawest looks you'll have at combat sports, you know, I'm including wrestling too. Like, I mean, obviously I feel like wrestling, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, but wrestling probably has maybe several more candidates in terms of like well-regarded documentaries that might be considered at that level. But for MMA, like I definitely would kind of put this up there in terms of realism, at least, you know, with something like a Be on the Mat. So this documentary I hadn't heard about until I started working at the Fight Network. And I think it was like various people that would have said, have you seen The Smashing Machine? Have you seen The Smashing Machine? Like, among MMA circles, this was like very already well known.
And then eventually, I believe it aired on the Fight Network. I'm pretty
sure. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to think so. And that was sort of my first exposure to it. I probably took it home and watched it in DVD form at that point.
So it was originally called The Specimen, but HBO wanted a better name, and they were informed, well, one of his other nicknames is The Smashing Machine. How about that? They're like, great. We love The Smashing Machine. Do you think we would have been talking about The Specimen?
But potentially, like, if it was this good, I feel like we would have anyway, but I like The Smashing Machine a lot more.
All right. Well, so, I mean, this focuses around Mark Kerr. And for those that are maybe unfamiliar, haven't seen the documentary, I mean, Mark Kerr was like he was an NCAA Division I champion in freestyle wrestling, won the NCAAs in 1992, and at one point was an Olympic hopeful. And him and Kurt Angle were battling for that spot on the 96 Olympic team. And it was Kurt Angle that ended up gaining the spot ahead of Mark Kerr. But Kurt Angle has stated that Mark Kerr might be like the most talented guy he ever wrestled, which is saying something from an Olympic gold medalist. But wow. Mark Kerr wrestled Randy Couture. He was somebody that, you know, obviously has like a real deep pedigree when it comes to amateur wrestling. But and Couture was the guy he beat to win the NCAAs. And in 92, they were wrestling at 190 pounds. So fast forward to Pride. And this is when Mark Kerr was estimating he was around 275 in Pride.
Jeez.
So, I mean, that tells you. And Ed stated that throughout his amateur wrestling career, never touched steroids, never touched any of that stuff. And it was getting into MMA. And he gives kind of his rationale for this. And I think it's one that is probably prevalent in a lot of fighters, was the idea of, out of strictly like self-defense, in terms of, especially with Pride, where there was no drug testing going on, and it was just sort of accepted that this is part of the game, and you're only handicapping yourself if you don't get into this. Like, it's a very vicious cycle. But I think that's existed in MMA in many circles, even where there has been drug testing. And in Pride, like, this was a feature, not a bug, when it came to the audience that was watching these action figures come to life and fight one another.
Well, even beyond maybe, you know, MMA, Lance Armstrong, you know, the Tour de France, like, I don't know if it was like a documentary, like, was it the documentary we watched where basically the argument was,
if you took out the guys that tested positive, it's like you're going so far down the line of who would have like won this race.
Because exactly.
Like, that upper percentage, it's like, this is the difference between a top eight finish and everybody else.
Yeah. Like, if you want to be in the top 10 or even like, you know, beyond that, like, you, this is basically a requirement, you know, for you to be on stuff. I almost, like, to my recollection, like, I had almost forgotten that this was a documentary purely like about painkiller addiction. I, in my mind, maybe for some reason, it's been like 15 years since I saw it, thought it was a lot more focused on steroid use. And there was really no discussion about steroid usage whatsoever. It was almost just like an accepted part of this game. I think it was it even mentioned, John?
Oh, it was definitely mentioned. I mean, you have him like basically like shooting himself up. Like, wasn't that?
I didn't know if that was painkiller or if it was steroids.
It's not really outlined regardless. But you're right. Like, steroid use is sort of just, it's like accepted that this is sort of what's being done. Like, this is just an accepted part of it. And I mean, you just look at the physical transformation of a guy who was already, you know, this incredible athlete at the time. And sort of like that kind of informs you of just the kind of sport you're going into. Also worth noting is that he trained at the Foxcatcher farm with Kurt Angle. And after John DuPont murdered David Schultz, you know, this was when there was this huge outcry, and John DuPont was sponsoring all of these wrestlers. Like, it was a reason that he was able to attract so many high level wrestlers. He was like paying their freight, and, you know, Kurt Angle left and trained elsewhere. And Mark Kerr received some criticism because he stayed and was able to still benefit from that funding. And the argument was like, listen, like, don't, don't handicap yourself this close to the Olympics, but it was kind of a controversial decision. And then, yeah, Angle beat Mark Kerr in the finals of the 95 FILA Wrestling World Championships and then would gain the spot over Kerr in the Olympics. So, wow. And then Kerr makes his transition to mixed martial arts in 1997 down in Brazil, and that expedites his entryway into the UFC and then opens the door to Pride, because as low as UFC is, like, this is the darkest period for UFC, and he was this heavyweight shining light, but the big money was over in Pride, definitely not in UFC.
Does it make you wonder if maybe the result of that particular match was reversed, what we would be talking about right now through history?
If Mark Kerr goes to the Olympics instead of Kurt Angle, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm sure that Mark Kerr would have been at least among the favorites to, like, if he is beating Kurt Angle to get there. And they went to overtime. It's not as if, like, Kurt Angle blew this guy out of the water or anything like that. They were very close in competitive skill. Yeah, I mean, it might have been very different. You would certainly think that of Kurt Angle and Mark Kerr, who would have the attention of professional wrestling, Mark Kerr by a landslide, I would say, would be having the attention of both major companies at that time, given his physique and, you know, a great personality as well. Like, this guy is a great talker. He would have been on all the talk shows, and I think he would have come off very well and probably would have had that run as kind of the Olympic gold medal hero that's, you know, got this great look. He's got a great personality, and it would only be a natural that there would have probably been interest from pro wrestling. It also would be frightening to see this guy in a pro wrestling setting, given his addiction issues and what kind of path he would have gone down. I mean, it might have been just catastrophic.
Well, look what happened to Kurt Angle, right?
I mean, they're very parallel in that sense. Like, it could have been, I certainly don't think Mark Kerr would have taken to pro wrestling the way Kurt did, but I certainly think he would have had that interest. It's an interesting kind of sliding doors scenario there. So, Mark Kerr, where we start things off, it's kind of just right away you are hearing, like, just, you know, he explains that sensing a man is scared to death while looking in their eyes at the start of the fight, you either cower away or impose your will, feeling that person wither away and the power that comes with that. And he started MMA by just having fun, but then asking him, why am I in it? Yeah, I don't know why I'm in it. That's sort of our start of this. Like, here's this guy that has these unique talents, but he's very conflicted about his participation in the sport. It's not like he was some big fan, or this is, like, he understands, like, the addiction of just that high you get from competing in such a raw fashion when you are in a cage with another individual and you're the one to emerge the victor. But I think he also was just almost felt as though he was a complete stranger to this world of asking himself, like, what is he even doing here?
I think, you know, as I watch the documentary again, I try to remind myself the context in which this documentary was released in 2002. And again, like, I imagine media of this sort of nature focused on MMA itself was pretty rare at the time. And I was I was impressed in 2024 at how honest and I think how in depth of a sort of presentation of, like, the mindset of a mixed martial arts fighter it was able to present from the onset of the entire thing. Like, you have here, and it helps that you have somebody like Mark Kerr, who is incredibly intelligent and who is incredibly eloquent with his words, and gives you this incredibly vivid description of just the mindset of what it means, or, like, why somebody would even choose to do this, even, like, the mystery of why he would choose to do something so crazy. For the moment, like, I thought it was a great opening scene.
I love the scene where he's in the waiting room at the doctor's office, and you have this woman that is just, like, in awe of, like, what is this? And she seems disgusted by it. But Kerr is just, I mean, I think every fighter, especially of this era, and probably a lot of it today too, have had to have, like, this is the equivalent of pro wrestlers, is it fake question of, oh my God, it's so brutal. And then you have Mark Kerr, who is just breaking this down. Like, these are all individual disciplines. Like, you are not aghast at seeing wrestling in the Olympics or karate or boxing, but you mix all of them together. That's what No Holds Barred is, which is generally what this was referred to at the time, less so than MMA. And then her answer, her question at the end, do you hate each other when you get into the ring? And maybe that's like a natural question. Like if you, to get into like that kind of mindset, do you have to have a hatred for the person? It's not the craziest question in the world, but he just explains calmly, like, no, not at all. You know, Kerr, I just thought he was such a great subject and very eloquent. Very like this guy could have been the person you put out there that could have combated a lot of the negative stigma. It just wasn't that level of figure in MMA in the United States at that time. And where UFC, like it's like a bad word in popular culture at this time in 97.
So if this, you know, Dwayne Johnson movie ever gets released, I imagine he'll do plenty of media, you know, just, and this might be the biggest exposure that I think Mark Kerr might have, you know, in terms of like interviews and things like that. So I will hopefully, you know, get a bit more of that, but this is something you realize immediately watching this documentary. He does not, we all kind of have our preconceived sort of ideas of what like a meathead, you know, that looks like a marker might sound like, and it tells you that we shouldn't be assuming anything, because this is one of the most gentle, well-spoken, intelligent people that I feel like you'll find in this space. And it's a total contrast to, I think, what we all might expect somebody like him to sound like.
Yeah. He explained how he was scared to death before he would fight, just completely focused when the fight would begin. And he takes us through his very first fight with the polar bear, Paul Varlins, and ends up fighting three times that night at the World Ballet Tudo Championships in Sao Paulo. And then fast forward to
First of all, so I think we know to many people, MMA is already brutal enough. UFC is brutal enough. Pride is a level beyond that. Ballet Tudo from Brazil is a step even above that in terms of violence and just complete brutality and a lack of really
and multiple sort of fights in one night. Like it's just
crazy. Headbutts like, allowed, eye pokes, like
soccer kicks, everything. Brutal. It was like Ballet Tudo was something like we aired this stuff and it was like it was another level from Pride at that time and who came out of it. But like just the idea that, you know, it wasn't all that long ago. We were still doing these tournaments where you would fight multiple times in a night. And I just think like that's insane at this point. Like it's
do they no longer occur like in like other like does a Bellator or did a Bellator do it? Does the PFL do one night tournaments or anything?
There's the occasional card, not among like the major promotions, but you still will get some. The way the commissions regulate it now is that you cannot fight over a certain amount of rounds in a night. So they might have to condense it where it's like, this is a 2-round fight. If it sets up another fight, that would be 3 rounds. You're not going to fight more than 5 rounds. So there is more, and it's very rare. Like you're just, especially at the highest level, you're not getting people that are fighting twice in one night. And I'm glad we're away from that. I'm glad we're away from a lot of this stuff. Like Pride is very romanticized. I would never want to go back to this promotion. Like it's, you know, there's aspects of Pride, like the knees to a grounded opponent, I don't have as much of an issue with as others. The soccer kicks are just insane. Like I don't know how you could rationalize that. And no commission would be. No commission is going to ever
It's all that plus the lack of drug testing as well. So you got all these guys that are juiced up, kneeing each other in the head and soccer kicking. And I mean, it had its time and maybe we could just enjoy it in history, but I'm with you.
So he goes to the UFC in July of 97 and then returns in October at UFC 15, has another two fights. And then it's off to Pride in 1998, where the offers are just so big. And in March of 98, he was originally set to fight Royce Gracie, and he was going to make $145,000 for that fight. But Gracie got hurt in the lead up and ended up that he could not fight on that card. So that's sort of the move. And he never fights for the UFC again. And the rest of his career, or at least for the next few years, is in Pride before he has his downfall. And then he's just jumping around to various promotions throughout the latter half of his career. But from 99 through 2004, I mean, he's exclusive to Pride.
I thought the documentary did a pretty good job of, you know, I think it gives the assumption that if you're watching this, you probably have at least heard of UFC, those letters in, you know, at this point. I think by this point, UFC had achieved a certain, like, at least mainstream notoriety in America. But nobody would have, at least if you're watching HBO, I think very few people would have heard of Pride. So I thought it did a good job of, like, building that bridge, explaining, well, what exactly is UFC? UFC is a brand. You had, what's his name? Eddie Goldman here. The host, MMA host from IATA, basically explaining UFC is a brand of no holds barred or MMA. And when it fell into financial issues because it was barred from airing on television, a lot of the more established fighters and the big name fighters went to Pride, which is this very extravagant, financially healthy at that point, you know, sort of top level MMA league.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, John and Wei go to the movies with a review of The Smashing Machine, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, based on the documentary around Mark Kerr. Plus, it's Rewind Away, covering the 2017 documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Also coming your way is reviews of Bound for Glory, King of Pro Wrestling, weekly editions of Collision Course, Post Pro Res with Karen Peterson and W.H. Park, and the XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, ad-free here at Post Wrestling Cafe. So he begins fighting for Pride in 98. He's got a few fights under his belt with that company when the filming begins in the summer of 99, and he's based in Phoenix, and this is when we're introduced to his girlfriend at the time, Dawn Staples. And she would, I mean, she's not in a whole ton of scenes, but she's a central figure in the documentary. And pretty much, you know, the camera is on these two, and they are not shy about their reluctance within this relationship. There is certainly a codependency that the two have on one another, and we see them break up at one point and then back together, and this becomes, you know, one of the areas of Mark Kerr's life where we are seeing that here is this fighter that we are now seeing on the outside and some of the struggles he is dealing with, this one being his personal relationship.
Certainly, yeah, it gives you like a more of a well-roundedness to not just this guy who's just like beast in the ring, but like an actual real human being with I think very relatable issues, I suppose you could say, you know, within a romantic relationship. And I have to imagine in the Dwayne Johnson adaptation, this might be an even more heavily sort of like, you know, emphasized portion. Oh,
definitely.
Of his life.
I think this will be a major part of the film. That would be my assumption here. And we get to see Mark Kerr, who, I mean, there are many moments of this documentary that it's just total fly on the wall where you are almost amazed that this is on camera. Early on, I mean, he's coming back from Mexico and he's like got a farm. He's got like a pharmacy in his car as he's coming back to Phoenix with all these drugs. It might have been Nubane that he shoots himself up with, but Nubane is an extremely dangerous painkiller, and that's something that we have, you know, that was what, you know, Tammy Sitch and Chris Kane, like a lot of wrestlers got into Nubane, and it just sounds like it's a horrendous painkiller to try and kick. So
now he does like say like within or shortly after or even within the scene, he says he said something to the effect of I'm paraphrasing. I don't feel pain as much. My pain tolerance is much higher. Like he's talking about this as if like, you know, when he goes into training or when he goes into fighting, he feels a lot less. And that is crazy to think about, you know, when you're allowing these sort of substances to be injected in a fighter who just like without feeling pain, you have no idea if you're you're hurt, or at least if you're, I don't know, maybe that's the intent.
We're also introduced to Mark Coleman. The two wrestled back in 1988, and Mark Coleman, another one that is heavily involved in, you know, amateur wrestling and then making the transition over to mixed martial arts. He has had a much bigger profile in the U.S., becomes UFC heavyweight champion. And they show, you know, the infamous fight with Murray Smith where Coleman just gasses out. It's a pretty famous fight at the time of just showing the dangers of, you know, when your cardio is gone and you're just left so vulnerable. And then there's the Petey Williams fight where Pete Williams hits him with this head kick that was like an all-time vicious knockout at the time, and Coleman being another one that goes to Pride and becomes a major star in Pride and actually becomes like a big focus of the documentary, sort of as the best friend or at least a close friend of Mark Kerr's, and ends up winning this tournament that we'll get into. But
did you find it interesting that the documentarians chose Mark Kerr as a subject instead of a Mark Coleman?
Well, it seemed like there was some kind of like personal friendship among one of the producers with Mark Kerr. I think they had that in already. And Mark Kerr is sort of seen as, you know, they have that relationship and start that. And, you know, they're following him a year out before this tournament. And it just, I think it was just happenstance that Mark Coleman ended up being, you know, someone that was tight with Kerr and ends up, it becomes this like kind of incredible juxtaposition of Mark Kerr's performance in that tournament and all he's dealing with. And here is Mark Coleman, who ends up, I mean, that is his MMA career highlight, is winning that loaded tournament in 2000. I don't know if I've ever told you my Mark Coleman story, but there was a day, this is when he was going to be going out to be one of the like assistant coaches on The Ultimate Fighter. And I think I had sent him some kind of message or something. And I get a phone call from Mark Coleman and I pick it up and he just starts chatting with me. And we end up talking for like an hour. And I'm like, man, it was like, this guy's very like open and stuff. He's just like calling me. And I'm like, we don't have this like personal relationship, but he's like, just, you know, just shooting the shit with me for like an hour. And then at the end, he's just like, he casually just refers to me as Moro. And I was like, am I in his phone? Like we've had him on the radio show before. And I'm thinking that my number has just been either it's Moro Ranallo's producer, or he's just put me down as Moro in his phone. And I'm thinking he thinks he's just spoken to Moro for an hour here. And I mean, I can't remember if I like informed him of this confusion or let it slide, but dude, it was an hour that we just talked on the phone. And I was just like, this is like, he's talking to me like I'm his best friend.
Oh my gosh.
Like we talked about everything. So it was, this is a number of years ago.
Goodness. Okay. I would have just went along with it. Yo.
I would say a few minutes in, Moro's very distinct. I would not say I've ever been confused for Moro. So, but there you go.
That's hilarious.
So we see Mark, he is preparing for his fight in September of 1999. This was at Pride 7 against Igor Vovchanchin, who was just an incredible heavyweight for his time. And, you know, just a stalwart in Pride. And we get access to Mark Kerr in the midst of like negotiating his contract with the Japanese representatives of Pride. He's working out with Coleman, the fighter, like we're in the fighter meetings here where they're going over the fouls and the clarification that soccer kicks are legal. And, you know, the rule set would come into play with this fight. But this is incredible access that this film crew has. It really does tell you that they were like, this was sort of the Wrestling with Shadows level of access that Mark Kerr was able to provide. And this was just a different time in Pride, where this was not uncommon that you would have a lot of media there and that you would have the ability to just be right there documenting all of this stuff, which I found fascinating.
Very much so. Yeah. This is like some of the stuff you don't, I mean, it's either on the one hand boring or maybe serves no purpose to promote a fight. So you would never see this on like a Countdown special or anything like that. But nonetheless, if you are a fan of this stuff, or even if you're not a fan and you're just fascinated by it, I think it's all incredibly like great footage, especially now now that, you know, obviously Pride is no longer around, it serves as like a really great sort of time capsule of what an entire fight week might encompass in that promotion.
The UFC would never be in need of doing this kind of thing. Like UFC, mm-hmm. it's very much in the same, like you watch an Embedded or a Countdown show, it's all the gloss and sheen of the major
sort
industry
of
leader
cutter now.
Exactly. And it's, yeah. and it's going, and, it, and it's very like, they're well done for what they're doing. And it looks high, very high production values. But if I was a PFL, if I was another company, like there is such a raw look at what these fighters go through that to me is an avenue that goes unexplored. I just think a lot of companies, I don't think they necessarily want to put a spotlight on the ugly side of weight cutting or getting into contracts. I don't think it necessarily serves the promotion, but selfishly as a consumer, like that's a lane that no one is occupying in that sense. And there's so much that is there just in the span of a fight week that is fascinating theater to present and humanizes your fighters in a different kind of way. And that kind of just got my brain going here watching this, because there was a great MMA series about a decade or so ago called Fight Factory, and it was following AKA. So you're looking at Cain Velasquez, Josh Thompson, Josh Koscheck, Daniel Cormier, and it was, I wouldn't say like this level of, but pretty like it was a pretty incredible series, and it was on a very, very small watched network, but it was an amazing series if you can track it down, like going into a lot of stuff that you were never going to see in a
anything USB. Controversial or that stood out to you or notable at least.
I'm pretty sure like drug use was like at least discussed in terms of like an industry reality and stuff. It like, again, it's been over a decade since I've seen this series, but I remember it being a series that was like, you know, pretty honest for in terms of like kind of what your expectation level would be in MMA. So this fight with Igor Vovchanchin, we see Vovchanchin landing several illegal knees and the fight is called off, and Mark Kerr is backstage protesting. And remember, like he's here communicating with the Japanese and trying to convey this, that was illegal. What happened? They're like, how are you doing? Actually not okay. I'm not doing so good.
That was honestly what stood out to me the most. Like in you would expect any competitor, first of all, let's remember he's been undefeated up until this point.
That's
so
right.
he's facing his first loss on record, and he rightfully justly feels like he was cheated out of it. Anybody in that position would have been justified to be completely just angry, emotional, yelling, complaining in the back. But this man goes into the back and he's the most respectful sort of complainer that you've ever seen. He's like, he, you know, bows like before even making the complaint, and just like very calmly explains the situation, even though, you know, he's pumped up full of adrenaline and painkillers and God knows what else. But it, again, continues to kind of tell you maybe the type of character that this person is, and just maybe even the general sort of like, I don't know, respectful atmosphere that seemed to be within this sort of Pride, you know, backstage area and locker room.
Also not like stuff reserved typically, like you would think like having like a manager, having a third party to deal with, like this is the fight he's just fought. And now he's in the back, like pretty much, you know, stating his own case. I mean, it just kind of shows you the sort of island you're on as a foreign fighter in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it is eventually turned into a no contest. And several years later, Sports Illustrated did this short video feature on Mark Kerr. This was in conjunction. The video was done, produced by Bobby Razek. So great filmmaker. And then Josh Gross did this incredible deep look at Mark Kerr. And in this piece, he notes that going into this fight, he said he was in no condition to fight. And during this lead up, he had crossed the line from taking pain medication as prescribed to becoming addicted. And the film crew, he said, actually like took him aside as they're filming him and basically told him, you need to get help when you get back home. Like this is the filmmakers that are obviously they've developed a relationship with Mark Kerr. They are not looking at this strictly from the lens of this is great for the documentary. They're concerned about this individual, and it gets really bad here. Shifting back to the documentary, Don notes that Kerr barely trained for this fight. And 2 weeks ago, we were out drinking and partying. Partying always being kind of that like code word in wrestling and other circles as can probably include many things. It's not like pin the tail on the donkey. It's not like blowing up balloons.
It's not Uno.
Partying.
And well, we don't know. We can only assume. But like, just given, I think,
not, what we learn later. Scene. I think we can classify it as that.
Given what we learn later about Dawn, I guess we can make educated assumptions. Yes.
And some of Kerr's, I found him to be just such a great subject here in terms of his introspection when it came to this. And he explains the incredible highs you receive while winning and conversely, like the lows you feel with a loss. And it's like this crazy yo-yo effect you have where you're either on top of the world or you feel like you are at the absolute bottom, and how important this is. And you see him and Igor after the fight, like they're both Igor's apologizing to him for the illegal knees, and they take a photo together. Like there's no bad blood between these two.
Oh,
and
it's amazing. Like, can you imagine? We, like, in general daily life, we want to kill each other if somebody cuts in front of us with our vehicle, or if somebody like gets in front of us at the grocery store line. Like, imagine if we settled
on my backdrop.
Yes, exactly. Imagine if we all settled our differences the way these two did, who just ended up illegally D-ing each other in the head. You know, like, hey, I'm sorry I did that. I didn't know the rules. Oh, it's okay. Like, these rules change all the time. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about kneeing me in the head like that.
Igor's explaining it, and Mark Kerr's like, oh, of course, it's a natural reaction. It's a natural reaction that you would do that.
He goes on to like even say, like, hey man, when you did this move to me, that you know, it was very good, good move. Like a level of like wonderful sort of martial artist type of respect, you know.
Mm-hmm. And in defense of Mark Kerr, of Igor, this rule had just been changed, I think, from the previous Pride event where knees to a grounded opponent had been legal in that. So I mean, it's also a new rule, and even today you have these fights that, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, of what's legal or what's not legal and what a grounded opponent is. I mean, it's crazy that we have such an ununified set of rules that they're trying to rehabilitate, but that's a different subject. And we have Kerr basically going to his doctor after this fight, this is him in the car, I think. And he's asking for opiates. He's looking for pain medication backstage on camera at the Pride show. And then he's back home seeking prescription drugs. And he's on the phone just saying a pill would be great, but I'd prefer an injectable if possible. Like, dude, he's got this down to like he's ordering Uber Eats here.
Oh, pretty much. Yeah. I think he could have ran Uber Eats out of his own house. I mean, with what we would see later with his collection. Do you feel like there would have been any hesitance from him showing all of this in the documentary? Because it didn't seem like it.
He explained, I watched, he's done a bunch of interviews over the years, and this is obviously a major topic. He's explained that he didn't get to see any of the film until they showed him the finished version. And he said when he was done, it was pretty much like the filmmakers, they were like, what did you think? And his response was, I need some time to like process this. I think he was definitely blown away by how vulnerable he is, what is on camera. Like, obviously,
well, he was speaking about it. Obviously, he had cameras there as he was showing off. I don't want to say showing off, but showing his collection of drugs and needles.
He certainly was open. And I guess it's just, you see that for yourself. And sometimes it's very different once you see it. I mean, the big scene of Beyond the Mat is not so much the Royal Rumble scene. It's Mick Foley watching the Royal Rumble scene. Mm-hmm. And it was like, what's his reaction? It's like, I don't feel like I was a great father. I mean, but yet he lived this. He knew his family was there watching this. But then you see it in the context, and it's just different once you see it in front of yourself, and you're sort of watching yourself almost like this out of body experience, seeing yourself on camera and the hole you're probably in, and probably still was when the Smashing Machine was first shown to him. He's like, I'm still living this life. It's not like I have, you know, escaped this dependency. And Dawn mentions the fact that she gave him an ultimatum. She would leave him if he didn't get clean. And Kerr just is definitely in this rock bottom phase. He describes it's fucked up from top to bottom. He knows he has a problem, and he's basically getting confronted. Like, his friend Darren here is concerned about him, And then in October, this is 1 month after the fight, he has an overdose and is hospitalized. And we see kind of this intervention staged in the hospital by two of his friends, where, like, you've got Mark Kerr, who is like, he's still holding up this incredible defense where, yeah, he's like explaining it like in this analytical way of, oh, this is what happened. They're like, dude, this is a black and white issue. You have a problem. And that breaks Kerr. Like, he's broken down just like that and realizes that, you know, he's in a really bad place and he can't keep up this facade even to his friends while he's laying in a hospital bed and trying to still maintain that. This is like, you know, just a small speed bump.
His friend specifically described it as a gray area that Kerr, I guess, had been living in. And my assumption is that they mean that Kerr was using painkillers, but in a controlled fashion, or what Kerr felt was a controlled fashion. And I guess his friends were suggesting it's a black and white issue. You're either on them or you're not. And that was, you know, enough to drive this man to tears and yeah, very powerful scene, very real scene.
It's, I thought this was one of the scenes that really, stayed with me. Like it's very rare. You're going to have people in your lives that are going to be able to be that frank with you. And let's, again, like, I'm not even thinking about this while we're watching it. They're doing this with a camera on them on top of it. Like it's beyond bizarre to me that you're
I think it takes
through this.
So watching this documentary, it's very clear. I don't know what sort of work that these documentarians have done before or after, but
John Himes has done like a lot of big stuff. Yeah.
Like anything notable that we would have heard?
Yes,
about?
Yes. If I pull up, just keep talking. I'll bring up.
But like, it just felt to me like it was, you know, all created at the hands of a very skilled documentarian, or like maybe very skilled cameraman who might have been able to just be a fly on the wall in a way that just let scenes kind of naturally play out without a whole lot of sort of like, I don't know, awareness from the subjects that they were being filmed. I have no real other explanation about how they were able to capture such like moments of intimacy, you know, from people that clearly aren't like, you know, trained actors or people that are, I guess, used to, I don't know, maybe not used to cameras in this fashion.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, John and Wei go to the movies with a review of The Smashing Machine, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, based on the documentary around Mark Kerr. Plus, it's Rewind Away, covering the 2017 documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Also coming your way is reviews of Bound for Glory, King of Pro Wrestling, weekly editions of Collision Course, Post Pro Res with Karen Peterson and WH Park, and the XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, ad-free here at Post Wrestling Cafe. So John Himes, he's done a bunch of films. In terms of television work, probably the most prominent, he was a producer for 2 years on NYPD Blue. Has also been involved in the Chicago series, like Chicago PD, Chicago Fire. In 2022 and 23, he was part of the sci-fi original Chucky that we've seen.
So things that are completely different from this.
Yeah,
this
but he's done... he's done a few documentaries here. He's done one called Fight Day that I'm not familiar with. That was a featurette. He worked on Universal Soldier, Day of Reckoning, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme a decade ago. So it's not like he's just been involved in niche stuff either. But yeah, he's been working in the industry since 1986. Started as a cinematographer, and this was, I would say, like his first big breakout hit in 2002.
Hmm.
So anyway, getting back to the subject. So he is, he checks out of the hospital and he disposes of all his drugs, all of his syringes. And it is alarming how much stuff he has on him in his house. Like this is like a warehouse full of vials and syringes. It's crazy when you see how much stuff that he has to go to a dumpster to just get rid of all this stuff.
Yeah. I guess it makes you ask how he had access to as much as he did.
Well, he's stated this a lot. I mean, this is like, he pretty much said, like, this is not hard to track down, that if you have the right doctors, there are doctors that are willing to just, and we've seen this in so many different instances of doctors that will just give you scripts for whatever you want. He stated there were doctors that they would make agreements like, hey, if you cut me in on some of these pills, I'll prescribe this to you. Like, just, you know, heinous people. Terrible. That when it comes to like drug dealers, like that's essentially what this is. And, you know, he stated that at this time, people were not aware of like the opioid crisis and a lot of this, like the access to painkillers. And over the last two decades, we've learned so much more about all of this. And, you know, this is an addict that is not having to jump through hoops to acquire the stuff. And this is just a real shining light on that, of like what he has access to, and absolutely no cap on any of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just terrible.
So he takes himself out of a fight in November because of the overdose. They keep like that aspect probably very quiet, and enters rehab and ends up coming back early the next year. So he's in rehab in like November, and he's fighting at the end of January when the Pride Grand Prix starts in the first round. So that is like a couple months in between fights, from the Igor Vovchanchin fight to January of 2000, when he's taking on Ensign Inoue in the fight that was supposed to happen in November and got delayed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you got to work, right?
You do have to work. And, you know, he had to push himself to all of this. So,
so at this point, like when he leaves rehab, we get a scene with Dawn, basically saying she's concerned about the sort of status of their relationship, because so much of it was Mark depending on her to carry him through his addictions. And her concern was, if he now has gone through rehab, hopefully successfully, and no longer requires her to depend upon to manage his addiction, she worries that with him being sober, he will realize he never really loved her in a true sense, and only depended on her, which he would mistake as love. That was like a level of, I think, depth and sort of like, I don't know, revelation that I wasn't necessarily expecting about this relationship. Now, something, the presentation of all of these like very big things in this documentary are like, I found it very fascinating. You know, we kind of blaze through these scenes, you know, without that much context in between. Like, maybe when we're talking about certain documentaries, there's certainly like more of like a, I don't know, a typical feature film, for instance, you get a lot more moments of like building up into like these big sort of like moments. This is a documentary that just kind of presents, like, we kind of time jump a whole lot, you know, from like he's asking for drugs, you know, at the end of the Pride event, to okay, he's overdosed, okay, their relationship might break up. But to me, at least, none of it ever felt jarring. It all felt like a very natural progression. We were just kind of getting it in like a very sort of like, I don't even really want to say highlighted form, but like we were just kind of diluting all these incredible big moments in their lives into the essentials. But we have enough information to be able to piece together what had happened in between. This is not a documentary that just kind of like leads you by the hand through every single moment. It just kind of tells you, hey, this happened and then this happened. You can probably assume what happened in between.
There's a lot of that where you are kind of just, this is dropped in your lap and you have to, it's almost like just this piling on.
Like a shock almost. Yeah.
This is all the things that this guy is going into, this extremely dangerous venture in fighting. And these are all the things that he's dealing with in the background: an overdose, hospital, rehab, relationship problems, all of this stuff. And all of that is stuff he has to balance as he goes into this next fight. And it kind of sets the stage. This was a gigantic tournament at the time when it was announced. It was going to feature, you know, Pride's access to some of its like biggest stars at the time. And this was like an open weight tournament. So you had a tournament that featured Kazushi Sakuraba, who should have been fighting probably at like 170 pounds throughout most of his career. And he's in a tournament where he could have ended up fighting Mark Coleman or Mark Kerr.
Yeah. Well, he did, So this is the tournament where he famously fought Royce Gracie for 90 minutes.
And who then, is the number one warrior in the world.
And then went on to fight Igor after the 90-minute fight with Royce Gracie. Yeah, it's insane what was allowed back then. But these are the scenarios that create these sort of legends, right?
I mean, it's a very historically significant fight of Royce Gracie and Kazuchi Sakuraba. And that's the part everyone remembers, like the 90-minute fight. They forget the Sakuraba had to come back later and fight a guy like probably like three weight classes outside of what Sakuraba's natural walk around weight would have been at the time. So the first round was in January of 2000, and Mark Kerr is scheduled to fight Ensign Inoue, who was supposed to be his opponent back in November. So they delayed it here until January. And I'm going to go to the Wrestling Observer newsletter from January 30th, 2000. And this is the recap of the fight between the two. Mark Kerr won a decision over Ensign Inoue, the two judges giving it to Kerr and the other ruling it a draw, to again show pro wrestling as opposed to an educated MMA crowd. Inoue, considered the big heavyweight star in MMA in Japan, got very little reaction coming out. They traded punches, standing, and finally Kerr took Inoue down and held him there for most of the rest of the fight. Kerr tried a choke and threw punches, cutting Inoue's nose open. With 1 minute left, the referee stood them up, but Kerr immediately took Inoue down again and kept them there. And it was Kerr getting the decision victory and advancing in the tournament and going on to the second leg of the tournament, which would take place May the 1st, where you could have up to three fights in one night if you made it to the finals, which was the case for Mark Coleman, who had to fight three times that night.
Mm-hmm. I felt like the fight scenes were like very like well edited. They were almost like in effect kind of haunting, with like this sort of like I would say more of like this ambient type of like haunting music underneath these montages. Some of it in slow-mo too. So it was a presentation that I felt like really emphasized, I think, all the brutality of what it was to fight. And also, I think took you like into Mark Kerr's head pretty well inside the fight itself, the way that you wouldn't necessarily feel just by watching it in real time.
It's also in the lead up to this fight with Ensign Inoue, like Mark Kerr gets, it feels like he's getting his life in order, like post rehab. He reconnects with Boss Rutan to train, not drinking. He's seems to be in the best headspace we see him in this. But then after the fight, and he broke up with Dawn during the lead up to this fight as well. But after the fight, he gets back together with Dawn.
We didn't mention it, but we also learned that Dawn is a former alcoholic who at one time promised that she would also be sober, I guess, around Mark. And it was because she wasn't at least completely sober, but she was drinking, that it was recommended, at least from like Mark's people around him, that he break up, or at least the relationship end. And beyond that, it seemed like Boss might have taken issue with just her perhaps being a distraction in general as well from his fight life.
Boss clearly sees this as a negative influence on Mark Kerr. He sees the athlete in Mark Kerr and sees this guy that could be the top heavyweight. He could win this tournament, but thinks that he is surrounding himself with it's the substance issues. It's Dawn. And he just thinks like he is looking at this from a coach's perspective of what is helping Mark Kerr and what is hindering Mark Kerr. And you can see where he slots Dawn in terms of that. But after the fight with Ensign Inoue, all of a sudden now we're seeing like Mark Kerr like drinking on camera, and he's rationalized, what's a couple of beers? I'm not doing needles anymore. So it's like you see the cycle of someone battling addiction, that now suddenly he's negotiating with himself and he's rationalizing what's a beer or two for me. I'm not into the worst stuff anymore. So it's like now he's trying to find his gray area instead of this being black and white.
Yes, yes.
So we go to, as well, now that he's back together with Dawn, just out of nowhere, he mentions a big fight that the two got into and that a gun was grabbed, there was a razor involved, and the police needed to be called. And they don't go into any detail here. Dawn never comments on this. It's sort of just Mark Kerr recapping what occurred.
Yeah, we don't really hear from Oh, wait, we do. We do. They do get. Do they get back together after this fight?
They don't. I mean, they don't break up from this.
Oh, okay. Do we see Dawn after this, I guess?
I don't think so. No, because we just go to the rest of the Grand Prix, and that's how the documentary ends. We just get the update on the two of them. They get married after the filming.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, Boss basically kind of hinted at this. Like, it wasn't so much that he didn't like her or that he felt she was a distraction. It was because I think it was suggested that they were getting into a lot of fights, and it sounded like an overall maybe unhealthy relationship at this point in time. Mark also mentioned within that fight, not only were, like, you know, guns involved, he mentioned, like, pretty graphic, you know, sort of actions from her involving razor blades and her basically kind of, you know, threatening to harm herself.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, very, very dark.
It's also, I mean, it's worth asking how much Dawn maybe removed herself from this filming process, because she was interviewed at a time. And I bring that up because in reading this SI article that Josh Gross did, this was in 2015, and she was reached out and she would not participate in that feature on Mark Kerr either. So it does make you wonder if she does not want to be attached or what. We don't even know what her feelings were of how she's not portrayed very positively in this documentary. I think that's fair to say, even though she's going through her own problems in this as well. I think there should be an understanding there. So May 1st, 2000, this was a really significant card in Pride's history, and Mark Kerr is in the second round paired up with Kazuyuki Fujita, who, you know, this was the guy who would earn the nickname Ironhead, which in fighting or wrestling, not a nickname you would want to acquire. For the amount of trauma that this guy could sustain and pretty much walk through. And it's Mark Kerr. Let me see if I just have the review here. This is again from The Observer. In the upset of the night, Fujita beat Mark Kerr via unanimous decision in 15 minutes. From all accounts, Kerr simply gassed out, something he had never done in an MMA career, which up to this point he had never lost a match, either in MMA or submission fighting, with several world titles in submission fighting under his belt. Kerr had shaved his head for the fight. Fujita came out to Inoki's theme music. Kerr took Fujita down and punched and kneed him, busting up his nose. Suddenly, about 5 minutes into the fight, Kerr just died. Fujita, who had Brian Johnston of New Japan in his corner, was able to take him down and pound on him and nearly got a choke. Fujita continued to physically overpower and dominate Kerr with several more takedowns and delivered knee after knee to him. It was a huge deal in Japan that a pro wrestler beat an unbeaten valetudo fighter and co-favorite to win this tournament under their rules, said to be a very exciting match. So this was right after the fight took place and had not seen it yet, but it's a brutal fight. Like, Mark Kerr has nothing left here. Kind of like similar to what we saw, like the comparison of like Mark Coleman gassing out with Maurice Smith, only Kerr is like down in the fetal position here, taking these brutal knees to the ribs and like all over. So this was a fairly big upset at this time when Mark Kerr, really the only blemish was the Igor Vovchanchin no contest.
So let's also maybe mention that up until this point, this documentary was really building up the potential of a Mark Coleman versus Mark Kerr match. And I believe it was maybe the quarterfinals that would have come after this. Quarters or semis, basically the next round.
It would have been the semifinals because Coleman beats Akira Shoji in the in the first fight on May 1st, and in the second round he faces Fujita before he faces Igor in the final.
Right. So basically, if Mark Kerr had beaten Kazuyuki Fujita here, he would have faced Mark Coleman in sort of like the grand finale of these two friends fighting. And so the film basically kind of leads you through that expectation, and that makes this loss that much more shocking. And the fact that he lost in this fashion. And again, the editing of the fight I felt was really good because it slowed this footage down super slow. So it's presenting you Mark Kerr in this incredibly helpless state already. You're seeing the disappointment of his head coach, Boss Rutten, from the corner. And they just slow this footage down so much that you feel helpless along with him. So it makes the moment feel like it's lasting forever, which I'm sure it felt like for him.
I thought that the post-match was even more dramatic, where you have the comparison of Mark Kerr, who is just, as he has explained, the highs and the lows of MMA. And we see both with Mark Coleman going on to win this huge tournament. And we're cutting to Kerr, who is laid out, getting his chin stitched up, and you have just the high and the low presented. And as we're watching Mark Kerr just laid out here, Coleman is talking about this being one of the best days of his life other than his daughter's being born. Like, he is on top of the world. It's a $200,000 prize for the winner. And you just, I just thought this was like such a, like, you didn't get the fight between these two, but in some ways this was to me just as dramatic to show you the, like, the difference of a win and a loss, and watching these two that are so connected, and yet here they are. One is in this spot of this glory, and the other is at this low point of facing this first real loss of his career.
Mm-hmm. One person won $200,000. The other person won chin stitches. And it's almost like almost a reversal of fortunes from the beginning of the film, where Mark Kerr really is this, like, you know, undefeated prospect, whereas Mark Coleman was presented as somebody who was kind of on, you know, like, past his prime, you know, 2 years of losses or just lack of success. And their fortunes were flipped, at least at the end of this documentary.
And that's kind of the conclusion of things. It's so this card takes place May the 1st of 2000. 10 days later, Mark and Don get married, and they would end up having a child together named Bryce. They later got divorced, and at the end, they say that he has not fought since July of 2001, but he would come back. He would end up fighting 10 more times until August of 2009, and during those 10 fights post-2001, he goes 2-8, and all of them ending in the first round. And that's something he's talked about, that, like, he got so big that his cardio was totally just gone at this time, that his conditioning was a big sacrifice when it came to the size he put on, and that it didn't make sense for him getting as big as he did. Of, like, whatever advantages he got from this, he paid with, like, the cardio that he was giving up. And it, you know, he was never at this level again. Like, he stuck around in Pride for a few more years, took, as you can see here, like 2.5 years off before he has the Yoshihisa Yamamoto fight, where he basically goes for a takedown and knocks himself out as he executes this takedown. It's a really weird finish. It only goes 40 seconds. And then he goes to the IFL. He's just pretty much a, you know, star from the past for hire to any of these startups. He does the Yama fight. Like, dude, he's losing to Oleg Taktarov in 2008. And then his last fight is Muhammad King Mo Lawal in M1 back in 2009. And that's when he realizes there is no future for him in the sport and gets out of it. Was, at least as my research showed, like, he was working at a car dealership. Don't know if he still is or not, but he is starting to, like, make the rounds, and he does, like, podcasts and interviews. He's still very open about his drug use. He's asked a lot about the Smashing Machine, and he's also dealing with this nerve issue that, you know, has certainly affected him. But I mean, you can see kind of the wares of this lifestyle that he lived, and it's going to be interesting to see how much he is included in the promotion of this film and involved with it. Like, pretty much he is just like, $7 Productions have bought the rights to everything minus the actual documentary, The Smashing Machine, but they have the rights to everything else. And, like, how much will Mark Kerr be focused on? I hope there is a spotlight on him. I think he's a really compelling figure, and this documentary is a testament to that.
Has he expressed through interviews any regret for I mean, the way he kind of dealt with his fight career, relying on, like, has he become any sort of spokesperson maybe against, you know?
He's very outspoken about the pay structure in MMA, how fighters have so few rights, and that it's something that should have changed a long time ago. Like, he's very outspoken about that. And I can't get, like, a great sense of, like, what his, like, I, just from, like, the stuff I've read and interviews this week, like, it would seem that I think he's happy that the Smashing Machine did probably has helped a lot of people that are dealing with addiction at a time when there's still a stigma that comes with addiction that was much more prevalent in 2003. But I think there's also probably an uneasiness about, you know, just how much he is out there and what is shown on this documentary. It seems to be something that I think he knows that at the end of it, I think this documentary is going to be his legacy in the sport more so than any one particular fight. I think that the Smashing Machine is what a lot of people are going to think of when it relates to Mark Kerr.
Certainly. I mean, it is for me.
I thought this documentary was great. Again, it has been a long time since I last watched it, but I think that it's really a must-see for an insight into multiple aspects that fighters have to deal with. And I would say, like, there's probably a lot of Mark Kerr stories that exist that just have not gotten this kind of focus and treatment. But it's something that I would be very curious to hear how a lot of fighters would respond watching something like this and putting so much into this and what you have at the end of the day, the problems that exist on a day-to-day level when you're competing at this level. It's a very, it is a mind fuck to be a mixed martial artist where you have so many stresses on you, not the least of which are, like, you can be cut after one fight. You could have an 8-fight deal in the UFC. You could be cut after one loss. Like, you have one bad day. It's like that could be the difference between you're making this and you're fighting on the regional scene. It's so unstable. And you can imagine, like, the mental drain it does on you and what it pushes you to. It's a really great look. And I don't know how many of, like, this level of openness you're going to get from too many fighters to have this level of access and be put on the screen in this kind of fashion.
Kind of hard to imagine these days. I mean, I felt like there was probably a low enough profile with something like MMA or NHB at the time, especially when you're talking about a fighter who's really just kind of popular in Japan and not so much in America, that I don't know if they felt like they were really giving up that much of their freedom. And maybe as a result, it allowed them to be that much more kind of open on camera. These days, I don't know. It certainly makes you wonder. I thought it was like, I mean, it's a very, very well produced, well directed, well shot, very well edited documentary that I think presents the topic in a very serious and, I would say, tasteful manner as well. A very raw and honest manner as well. It's not the type of documentary that I think requires a whole lot of dressing up. I hate to even, like, compare it because they're almost completely different categories of documentary. But, like, we just talked about the David Arquette documentary, which to me felt like a lot more, like, it almost felt like a reality show, which would be sort of the other end of the extreme when it comes to documentary style filmmaking. This just felt a lot more like, you know, natural scenes, cameras on, and you just kind of let the sort of scenarios play out. With a bit of guidance here, you know, in the form of editing, this I think it should be seen not just if you're maybe a fan of MMA, but if you are somebody who wants to get a glimpse of what this sort of world might do to somebody with an addictive personality, especially when it was unregulated at a time like it was back then. And where I'm not even just maybe talking about addiction to painkillers, but the addiction to the high of performing in front of a large crowd and getting success and being celebrated by a massive crowd. I mean, this is something we hear about professional wrestlers all the time. That's why it's so hard to get away, because you're addicted to the pop. And there are some real chemicals that are released in your head when you're being exposed to, you know, 50,000 people chanting your name, that I'm sure are just as powerful as many, you know, illicit drugs. So a very honest and impressive presentation, especially for its time.
Yeah. I don't have too many, like, criticisms. I like, you watch it and it's 90 minutes and they throw a lot at you to process and kind of leave the viewer to sort of do the concluding of the impact that it's having. But I never felt like it was similar, like we've talked about with the Iron Claw, where that last hour of the film, it just seems like it's so much. Didn't strike me like that in this documentary, but I do wonder if that's going to be a struggle for the film, if they have, say, a 2-hour window, and is it going to feel as though they can't give the proper kind of attention and focus on any one specific area here? Cause you can take this in many different directions in the film. So I'm definitely curious how there's certainly going to be an interesting comparison point between the documentary and the film.
I think they'll probably focus on maybe certain aspects. I mean, this is a story about addiction first and foremost, and somebody trying to overcome it. So I imagine that'll be the main thing. And then however you attach, you know, either Dawn to it or the Pride Grand Prix to it, will probably maybe be like, how much will they focus on the Mark Coleman aspect of I'm curious too, because like it almost felt like 40% of this documentary was a documentary about Mark Coleman too, wasn't it? So well, if you cut that out, or at least like maybe only portrayed Coleman as like a supporting act, will that change the feel of it? Will it change the runtime? Or did they find like the juxtaposition with Mark Coleman powerful enough that it needs to be a central sort of part of the, you know, Dwayne Johnson film? We'll find out. Who plays Mark Coleman? Has to be somebody just as big as The Rock.
I'm always so bad at these. Like, I just, it's so hard to imagine like other actors playing these people. Like, I just, I don't know if I could imagine like Zac Efron playing Mark Coleman.
I don't know either.
He's got to get his, you know, this, he didn't build this physique for like, you want to get your most out of it. So I don't know.
Yeah. It makes you wonder.
I am curious as well, kind of like, this is going to be an MMA centric film, and granted it's Pride, but I mean, how, like, for instance, like fighter pay issues, I really don't expect to be, prevalent in this as part of the story.
It wasn't really in the documentary either.
It wasn't either, but it's kind of, if we're looking at Smashing Machine post, like what his post career is like, I mean, and you know, this is a guy that was, you know, it's not like he got rich off of this industry either. I only bring that up because when this film was announced, okay, you have Dwayne Johnson and his company attached to it. Now we have a TKO board member as well that is producing and starring in this. And I don't think you can, I don't think that's like conspiracy theory lane. You're going into that, and he does have a more vested interest in, like, you are in business with the MMA leader as well. And, you know, this is somebody that I am sure Mark Kerr, he's going to be very outspoken in terms of UFC, if he's being honest.
Yeah, which is why I think it was so surprising when this was even announced that he was willing, like Dwayne Johnson was going to attach himself to something that was going to basically focus on painkiller addiction, which is something that is kind of like hidden away from and not really presented into mainstream discussion from either WWE or you know, UFC. I get the sense there'll be a lot of, this was the past and this is completely different from the thorough sort of like regulation that exists within the UFC today, a professional organization where none of this will ever happen again.
Well, we will see. Certainly will be interesting. We don't even know like realistically, like the timetable of this. Certainly, like what an interesting slate that Dwayne Johnson has Moana 2 and the Smashing Machine in his on deck circle of rules.
A lot of stories to finish. So that was it. A bit of an edited version of our review of The Smashing Machine from February of 2024. If you want an extended version of that particular podcast, you can find it in our archives at postwrestlingcafe.com. Just simply search for Rewind Away number 150. John and I will be back on Thursday of next week talking about Dwayne Johnson's Smashing Machines. So make sure you're signed up for that. Again, postwrestlingcafe.com. Thank you for listening. Talk to you guys later.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.